Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Murder Suspects and Evidence Requirements Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 10, 2012, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Smith v. Cain. The question in this case was whether murder suspect's Brady rights were violated because his attorney's office failed to hand over evidence that could have helped in his defense. In an opinion delivered by Chief Justice Roberts, the Supreme Court reversed the decision of the lower courts and held by a vote of 8-1 that the petitioner's Brady claims demand a reversal of his conviction. Justice Thomas filed a dissenting opinion. To discuss the case, we have Adam Conrad, an associate at King & Spalding. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Conrad.
The United States Supreme Court recently issued a decision in Smith v. Cain, case number 10-8145. For purposes of full disclosure, I helped author an amicus brief in this case on behalf of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers in support of Petitioner Juan Smith. This case concerns a criminal defendant's right to due process of law under the principle stated in Brady v. Maryland and its progeny. Decided nearly 50 years ago, Brady set forth what is now a cherished and familiar rule of criminal procedure. It held that prosecutors must disclose evidence favorable to the defendant and material to the defendant's guilt or punishment, irrespective of the good faith or bad faith of the prosecution. Failure to disclose such evidence violates due process. The principle of Brady is easy to state, but the devil is in the details, and the details of Brady doctrine have tripped up even well-intentioned prosecutors. In recent years, there have been some high-profile Brady violations, including in the prosecution of former Senator Ted Stevens. And the Department of Justice recently announced comprehensive new rules for training federal prosecutors in Brady compliance. Brady's materiality requirement has been particularly thorny. Evidence is material if it could reasonably be taken to put the whole case in such a different light as to undermine confidence in the verdict. That standard does not apply itself, and taken together with the requirement that materiality must be evaluated in the context of the entire record, it can make for some tough calls for prosecutors trying to meet their discovery obligations. Smith v. Cain is the court's latest foray into the materiality arena. The facts of Smith are relatively straightforward. Petitioner Juan Smith was charged by the state of Louisiana with murdering five people during an armed robbery. The prosecution's case turned on the testimony of a single eyewitness, Larry Boatner. According to the evidence, Boatner and several of his friends were gathered at a home in New Orleans when at least three armed men broke into the home and demanded drugs and money. After some commotion, one of Boatner's friends attempted to escape, and the intruders began shooting. Four of Boatner's friends and one of the armed men were killed, but Boatner survived. At trial, Boatner identified Smith as the gunman. He testified that he had no doubt that Smith was the perpetrator, and also that, on the night of the crime, he had been face-to-face with the gunman. That testimony was unequivocal. The state did not offer any other eyewitnesses or physical evidence to link Smith to the crime. On the basis of Boatner's testimony, a jury convicted Smith of the murders. After an unsuccessful direct appeal, Smith filed for post-conviction relief in Louisiana State Court. During that process, he obtained several pieces of evidence that the prosecution had not disclosed. The most important were some police notes of detectives' conversations with Larry Boatner. According to those notes, on the night of the murders, Boatner stated that he could not identify any of the perpetrators. And 5 days after the crime, Boatner again stated that he could not ID anyone because he could not see their faces. In other words, he would not know them if he saw them. Smith argued that the prosecution violated Brady by suppressing this evidence and that his conviction should be vacated. After the state courts denied relief, the Supreme Court granted cert and, in an 8-1 decision, reversed. The Chief Justice authored the majority opinion for eight justices. The court's opinion is remarkable in at least two respects. First, its brevity. The majority opinion barely spills onto a fourth page. Even in easy, unanimous cases, that kind of economy is unusual. Second, Brady cases are often close and contentious, perhaps reflecting the unclear boundaries of the materiality requirement. Here, however, with the exception of Justice Thomas, traditionally conservative and traditionally liberal justices joined forces. A few things made this decision an easy one. There was no dispute that prosecutors failed to disclose the evidence. nor did anyone dispute that the evidence was favorable to Smith and that it could have been at least somewhat valuable to impeach Larry Boatner at trial. That left a single question. Were Boatner's undisclosed statements material to Smith's conviction? On that question, the majority did not hesitate. It held that Boatner's statements were plainly material. According to the court, because there was no physical evidence or any other eyewitnesses, Boatner's testimony was the only evidence linking Smith to the murders, and the undisclosed statements directly contradicted his trial testimony. That was enough to require reversal. In dissent, Justice Thomas agreed that the undisclosed statements by Boatner could have been used as impeachment evidence, but he chastised the majority for not considering the entire record. According to Justice Thomas, Boatner consistently identified Smith as the perpetrator throughout the criminal investigation, including twice in the immediate aftermath of the crimes and also in photograph arrays. Justice Thomas also noted that Boatner's identification was thoroughly cross-examined at trial. Taking this evidence as a whole, Justice Thomas agreed that it was possible the jury could have reached a different verdict, but not probable. He therefore deemed the undisclosed statements made by Boatner as minimally impeaching and therefore not material. Although the majority agreed with Justice Thomas that the jury may have discounted and rejected Boatner's undisclosed statements, it refused to speculate about which of the two statements the jury would have believed. So, at bottom, the court's holding seems to be a fairly simple one, that where a criminal prosecution turns on the testimony of a single eyewitness, evidence tending to impeach the eyewitness's identification of the perpetrator is material. That holding alone does not significantly advance Brady doctrine. The court did not make any groundbreaking rulings. In fact, many years ago, the court issued a very similar decision in Giglio versus United States. The majority does not cite that opinion, which is somewhat puzzling. But in Giglio, the court vacated a conviction where the prosecution suppressed evidence, undermining the credibility of the only witness linking the petitioner with the crime. Nor was there a circuit split here. In fact, the courts of appeals have frequently issued similar decisions along the same lines. That means that Smith is a rare example of error correction, but this was a truly egregious Brady violation. There was no physical evidence. Boatner's eyewitness identification of Smith was the linchpin of the prosecution's case. Had there been, for example, a murder weapon or fingerprint evidence, Boatner's eyewitness identification would not have been so central to the verdict, and perhaps there would have been a different outcome. Also, notably, there were no state court opinions in the case. The justices who may have been inclined to defer to state court findings had nothing to which to defer. Also, Smith may be viewed as a companion case of sorts with the court's decision last term in Connick versus Thompson, which was a 5-4 decision. Notably, Connick involved the same district attorney's office in New Orleans. In that case, the prosecution admitted that a Brady violation occurred, and the petitioner filed an action under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, claiming the district attorney's office should be liable for failing to train prosecutors in Brady compliance. But the court held that Section 1983 does not provide a remedy in that circumstance, at least on the basis of a single Brady violation. Smith reminds us that, despite the outcome in Connick, the court considers Brady violations serious business. Ultimately, Brady law is about fairness to defendants and confidence in the judicial process. Prosecutors have a duty not just to win cases, but to do justice. The recent spate of high-profile Brady violations and the court's reticence to impose a Section 1983 remedy in Connick make it all the more important to catch and correct Brady violations when they appear. In the end, Smith is one more data point to help guide prosecutors in complying with Brady. And Smith makes clear that the integrity of our criminal justice system rests on constitutional principles of fairness and due process. Where a criminal conviction turns on a critical eyewitness and the prosecution failed to disclose evidence tending to impeach that witness, those principles demand reversal.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.